is Thomas Sopranovich for State of Nevada. If you're ready to proceed.
Your Honor, can I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal? May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Thomas Sopranovich. We've raised 5 issues. I'd like to start with issue 3, and that involves the trial court's ability to remove a bilingual prospective juror from the jury meeting. NRS 6.010 says that in order to be a juror, you have to have sufficient knowledge of the English language. So what does that mean in the context of a trial? Well, this is what happened in this case. Juror number 130, Mr. Martinez, he was a Hispanic male. He spoke English and Spanish. The court began with preliminary questions to see if the jurors were qualified under NRS 6.030 and 6.010. And then she asked, does anyone have sympathy or prejudice or bias that would affect their ability to be fair and open-minded? Juror number 130 raised his hand to talk about his daughter being accused of neglecting an elderly man. She was arrested, but then it went away. There was no conviction. Then he added, "My English is not good." Subsequent to this, the court had a bench conference where she decided which jurors were qualified and which weren't before they started voir dire. And court immediately said, as to juror 130, "This is a man who doesn't speak English well. He speaks Spanish." And then she discussed the comments he made about his daughter. The state immediately went and said, "Well, I'm not sure he's fair." The defense asked a question further. Now, I think it's important to realize the first thing the court said when she decided this juror may not be able to be qualified was his English language. Our Spanish language, his inability to speak English. And this is important because, as the court knows, in Villamapa, when the state had sought to remove a juror from a panel, and they used the excuse that, well, he understands English well, this court, based on those circumstances, found structural error. So what does NRS 6.010 say? It says that you need to have sufficient knowledge of the English language. That's a very subjective test. It's subjective in that each individual judge can make his own decision. The decision can be arbitrary, it could be ambiguous decisions. And when you compare that to the federal system, in the federal system, you have a much more objective system. In there is a two-part test. The person needs to read, write, and understand English language with a degree of proficiency sufficient to fill out satisfactorily the jury qualification form, and two, speak English. Under that test, it's very objective. So once they fill out the form, you just need to make sure they can speak English. So this brings a problem in Nevada because even though we sometimes think that we don't have minorities on jury panels or as jurors because of a problem with the veneer selection or a problem with Batson, we also have a problem with the way the courts are used for removing jurors based on their ability to speak or inability.
Did the attorneys get to voir dire this witness or this juror? Excuse me.
No, we were not allowed to voir dire the witness, the juror. You're right.
Isn't that error? Isn't that
automatically error? I think that's error that
you can't. That you can get a chance to traverse. I mean, every case I had, everybody was allowed to traverse, whether it be the state or the defense.
And, Your Honor, you are correct. Because under all the cases that this court has, Salazar and Whitlock, it's reversible error automatically for the judge to refuse to allow the parties an opportunity to question the jurors.
Wait a second. Why wouldn't this be harmless error?
Because he was removed, based on an improper reason. And if it's an improper reason that affects the jury selection process and can contaminate the verdict, as this court knows, in Ohio versus Powers, the Supreme Court said that if the very basis, if the jury selection is not lawful and not done correctly, then we can't have any confidence in in the verdict.
What was indicated that showed his right to an impartial jury was violated or that he was prejudiced?
Well, just as in Batson, we're allowed to bring up the right of the juror as equal protection rights, we're raising an equal protection right for that juror to be on there. And also, we have a right to have minorities on the juror and not to have someone just removed based on one comment for language. If the court has no more questions about that, I was going to go to issue two, the sufficiency of the evidence.
Isn't that issue three? Isn't it failure to reverse is one issue, and then the sufficient knowledge of the English language is the second issue?
That's correct, Your
Honor. So it's two separate issues.
It's actually,
and you're saying there's two violations there.
Yeah, so it's the failure to traverse, the voir dire, the English language, and then it can also be considered a challenge for cause, failure to traverse. So there's three components to that issue.
Could you go to the Ferretta case, the Ferretta issue?
Issue one. Your Honor, in this case, the defendant multiple times showed that he had a problem with his attorney, and he voiced this first in a letter, and he asked to be able to represent himself. At the hearing, what happened is the court just questioned him about, well, why can't you get along with the attorney? You know, only a fool has his own attorney in representing himself. The court did not really take to heart his request to have to represent himself. So he sent a letter to the court, and then they had the hearing a few days later. And he said, you know, I want to represent myself, and I'd like to have Connor Seif as the standby counsel as my advisory. He wrote a letter into the record. He said, my trust is shattered. I'm being thrust in a combative situation with one of his attorneys, and I feel I could do a good job in representing myself. Well, the test for Ferretta is the defendant's decision knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of his right to counsel. The court never did a canvas. The court did nothing. The court just continued to talk to him and try to suggest that he can get along with his attorney better. And when they had this hearing, they had it outside the presence of the state, but they also did it right before they were going to have a suppression hearing. And so the court basically convinced him to allow the suppression hearing to go forward, which he did. But he said, I can see where this is heading. I guess I'll just let you go on with your business. So it's very clear Mr. Sopranovich knew that no matter what he said, the court was not going to let him represent himself.
Didn't he also indicate that he was going to take the court's advice? He'd hash out his concerns with his counsel on the record?
He did, but the court should have still done the Ferretta canvas.
Well, he withdrew his request before a Ferretta canvas could have been done. Isn't that the case?
That's not the way I interpreted the facts.
How do you interpret that?
He said that he wanted another attorney. He wrote it in a letter.
Prior to when he got into court.
And he read the letter in court, a letter in court. And the judge, rather than doing a Ferretta canvas, began trying to convince him out of the situation. Clearly, there was some conflict. Whatever the conflict was, the court needed to do at least a Young hearing to determine the extent of the conflict and adequately review what the conflict was. The motion was clearly timely. It was a month ahead of the trial, and he offered to represent himself. So there was absolutely no reason for the court not to either do a Ferretta canvas or to do a Moore hearing or a Young hearing.
But he told the court that he would hash it out with his attorney and see if there's any way of saving it. Hash out his concerns, and, you know, maybe there's a way of saving it. And the court questioned him. You're talking about hash it out between yourselves. Yes. I mean, so the court asked him if he wanted to go forward with the attorneys. He conceded those attorneys were competent. He acknowledged there were some conflict between he and the attorneys, and he told the court he wanted to hash it out with the attorneys.
Well, he did that because of the way the court spoke to him when he asked to represent himself.
Where is that reflected in the record?
He read the letter into the court, and the court kept asking him other questions rather than stopping the proceedings and doing a Ferretta canvas. She did no forensic canvas at all. She just kept talking to him. I interpreted what she was doing was not trying to do a forensic canvas, but to do a Moore hearing or a Young hearing to resolve the conflict. A lot of times these two things coincide at the same time because the conflict is so bad, the defendant wants to represent themselves. So there can be a lot of two things going on at the same time. Anybody have any other questions about issue one? I'm down to 5 minutes. I'll just briefly want to talk about sufficiency maybe for a minute. I don't know if the court has any questions about that. Thomas was convicted of second-degree murder of his elderly father, and the coroner could not say with a reasonable degree of medical certainty what caused his death. I mean, he was found in his home. He was in hospice. There was certainly no proof of the corpus delicti. I've outlined the corpus delicti cases that this court has ruled on. And based on all those cases, the state was unable to prove corpus delicti. In the cases, Azibil, Frutiarca, Gibson, I'm really not pronouncing these right, Middleton and West, this court has always looked to see, well, where was the body found? Was it found, like, taped up in a can? Was it found out in the desert decomposed? Something that suggests that other than natural causes occurred when they find the body. In this case, there was nothing to suggest anything that natural causes occurred. So if you have any questions, I'll
take it. Nope. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Krista Berry, Chief Deputy District Attorney for the respondent. I will touch on the issues in the order that my counterpart raised them. However, the first issue of jury selection, I think, can be dealt with rather summarily in that it is just factually incorrect from what happened at the record in the district court. The parties held a bench conference and agreed to strike approximately 10 jurors by agreement. That was hashed out. Juror number 130 was not the only juror as part of this group. As part of this group, four were stricken for bias against the defendant, and one was stricken for bias against the state, which is juror 130. Although asking follow-up questions was mentioned briefly at the bench, after that, the parties all agreed to strike this entire group, including juror 130, and I think this bench conference, the transcript as a whole, is very insightful, as there was a juror, number 65, who the parties did not agree on, and that juror was not stricken. That juror remained in the pool.
So it's your statement that 130 was part of the group that was agreed to be removed from the jury panel?
Yes, the bench conference dealt with not just juror 130. It was approximately 10 jurors. After the close of basically the general questions from the district court, the parties approached and they had a bench conference about different people that had raised either hardships or issues. And like I said, four of those were for bias against the defendant. And they were all done by agreement, set individually when each was discussed. And then at the end, the judge said, here's what I have, summarized which ones have been agreed upon. And the parties both said, yes, that's correct. So this was done by agreement and for cause of bias, not for language. The only time that language was mentioned in regard to juror 130 was at the very beginning when the judge said, remember juror 130, he couldn't speak English and his daughter was arrested. No one else after that mentioned the language issue at all. All the parties spoke about was bias. And then the parties agreed to strike juror.
Okay, Ms. Burke, I asked you another question just kind of related to that, because I wasn't aware of that from reading the material. There was an agreement. I thought it was just done by the judge sua sponte. The question that occurred to me, though, is sometimes in doing, the veneer comes in and the judge asks preliminary questions to try and determine if there's prejudice. Somebody blurts out something that's obviously prejudicial either to the state or the defense. It happens all the time, you know, like that. Does the judge have the ability then sua sponte just to remove that juror, or do you think that each side could preserve their peremptory challenges, or how should that procedure be handled?
Well, I think under the case law, the the district court would if the bias was clear. We cited several cases in our brief about how you cannot, you can't look beyond, you have to look beyond a juror eventually getting to the point where they say, yes, I could be impartial if they have made statements throughout the veneer that indicates a clear bias, such as very similar circumstances, which is exactly what we have here. His daughter was a caregiver, was, in his view, wrongly arrested for negligence, which turned out not to be accurate. However, I in my years, I've not seen it handled that way. The bench conference, when you hash out issues with various jurors and see what you can do by agreement, is the typical course. And like I said here, they didn't agree on all of them. There was at least one juror in that discussion that the parties didn't reach an agreement on, and that juror went back to the pool for further voir dire.
What's your record citation for what you're saying about the bench conference and the confirmation that 10 were stricken?
Certainly. The entire bench conference is the fifth volume in the appellate's appendix from 1013 to 1024. The summary that the judge put on the record was at 1024. Juror 130 specifically was 1019 to 1020. And the juror that I mentioned, number 65, who the parties did not agree on, was at 1017.
Thank you.
So Thomas, the defendant requested to question the potential juror. It wasn't 130, it was 65, number 65?
No, 130. What happened, basically to paraphrase the bench conference, the judge gave some identifying information for juror 130. Parties all said, oh yes, I remember. The state said he couldn't be fair. He said bias. Defense counsel said that maybe I can quote unquote fix that. The state said, but he already said he could be biased. The judge said, seems like we should strike him, and the parties said agreed. And then at the
You're saying that the defense counsel agreed after that colloquy?
Yes.
For sure. That's yes. What the 1020, 1019, the 1020 will show.
Yes, and at 1024 at the end, the judge went through and listed all of them just in chronological order. So juror 130 is towards the end. And again, all the parties said that's correct. That's what we'd agree to.
Just before we leave that point, as a general principle, do you think the court has to let counsel question somebody who demonstrates bias in their answers? Bias that would rise to the level of cause.
As the cases that we cited in our brief indicate, I would think no. Because it's pretty clear that you're supposed to err on the side of striking a juror if there is a question of bias. The more important consideration is that the jury that is impaneled be impartial. And every action should be taken to ensure that. And so if there's doubt, it should go to err on the side of striking that biased juror. So I think the cases make it clear that when you have such a strong indication of bias, the judge could do so. However, I don't think that was an issue here, simply because all the parties ultimately agreed. Anything else on that issue?
If you would go to right to counsel or lack of self-representation.
And I think at the outset what needs bears mentioning is that we need to look at the record as a whole. And there were some factual inaccuracies as well in my counterpart's recitation of the facts. What's important here, there was a prior letter. However, when the Jackson v. Dental hearing began and the appellate was given the floor, also I think it's important to note that the state was not present for this hearing. To give the appellant a chance to speak very candidly to the court. He said, no, I don't want to talk about that letter. I have a new, quote-unquote, follow-up letter. And the letter he read into the record at that time was a different letter than the handwritten letter that was included in the appellate's appendix. We don't have a written copy of that letter because he simply read it into the record. And that letter, all he talked about was a new attorney. He didn't say, I want to represent myself. He said, I would like a new attorney. He spoke at length about all the conflicts he was having with this attorney regarding pretrial writ, discovery, approach to cross-examining witnesses. And it's clear from the record of that hearing that everyone involved considered that to be a request for a new attorney. In fact, defense counsel explicitly referred to it as a request for a new attorney, as did the court when she denied it at the end of that hearing. And at no point did appellant object or interrupt to say, I think you misunderstood me, I really want to represent myself. He proceeded solely on a request for a new attorney at that hearing.
He said, nevertheless, I feel I could do a good job in representing myself. Certainly I'm motivated. Then there was a colloquy about having a fool for a client. So at some point at that hearing, despite the letter read into evidence, there was a discussion about him representing himself.
There was, and it was, that hearing was approximately 23 pages long in the transcript, and this portion that you were referring to, Your Honor, I believe it was just a paragraph, and it was when he prefaced that with, that's why I had considered representing myself, indicating, I think that's important for a couple of reasons. Considered, I think, is telling because, by definition, that is not an unequivocal word, which would be required to trigger Ferretta. It, by definition, it is equivocal. I'm considering it, I'm thinking about it, I'm mulling it over. It's not a clear and decisive word. It's also, I think, important because it's past tense. He's not saying, that's why I'm considering it. He's not saying, I will consider it going forward if a delay occurs. He's saying, that's why I had considered it, referring to the letter that he opted not to read, instead going forward with this new request for a new attorney. And then the district court did proceed to hold a very lengthy closed-door hearing with him on all of these issues following Young. Young cautions the district court that they do need to get into the specifics of the competence of the representation and the extent of the conflict. The district court judge did that in this case. In fact, appellant noted he had no doubts as to the competency of his attorneys, and at the end stated that he was satisfied with their discussion and said a couple of different times that he would just hash out his issues with his attorney. So there really, at no point, was that unequivocal request to represent himself. Instead, appellant presented it, and the parties present all took it to be a request for a new attorney. Even at the end,
you've got 5 minutes.
Sorry. I'm sorry. even when defense counsel and the court referred to it specifically as a request for a new counsel, appellant did not correct that, and so the parties present are able to interpret that, I think, better than the cold record. And so that's how they all took it. No one thought it was a request to represent himself.
How about the sufficiency of evidence that Ms. Dickinson raised?
Basically, the sufficiency of evidence claim seems to be about cause of death, indeterminate cause of death. All the evidence and all of the medical examiner's testimony in terms of cannot rule out natural causes, but also could not pinpoint one that was the cause of death, all of that evidence was presented to the jury. And the jury is the trier of fact in this case. They did their job, and they evaluated that evidence, and they weighed it, and they came up with a guilty verdict of second-degree murder. There is certainly evidence, as listed out in the responsive brief, that supports that verdict, and so it should not be disturbed on appeal. Are there any further questions?
Thank you. Anything additional? Thank you.
Ms. Dickinson, help us with juror number 130. I'm confused as to whether was one of the public defenders representing Mr. Spanovich at trial?
Yeah, it was a public defender who represented him.
Now, did they actually ask to traverse, or at least to try to question 130, or did he or she agree to strike that juror? Because it sounds somebody's confused on this.
Well, I'm stunned, to tell you the truth, because all you have to do is look at the prosecutor's brief, where she gives you everything that was said about this juror on page 28 and 29. She takes it out of the record, prints it out, and gives it to you. Nowhere in her brief does she say there was any agreement and 10 people we agreed on.
None Dickerson, of that was there in fact a bench conference as to the 10 jurors? And
there was a bench conference. There were other jurors that were removed. That's correct. We objected to this juror. We asked to do voir dire. The judge said no. Now, what more could he have done? I'm not sure what the prosecutor is now saying. She's got it all printed in her brief, and there's nothing there that says, well, we agree, because there was no agreement. I think it's an extrapolation of the bench conference. Okay, so the judge ruled, and now 10 were left, and I'm not sure what she thought we were going to do next. I mean, once the judge rules, You've made your record. So no, there's no agreement, and I'm just looking at page 28 and 29 of her brief. It's not there. So I'm not sure what she's talking about, because we did observe
her. A question as to the representation on this jury of Hispanic veneer?
No, all the defense attorney said is, I'd like to voir dire this juror. And so the judge said no.
What's the record cite for that? Is it in the 960s?
The site for hers is volume 4, 95960.
But where you say that the defense asked to voir dire the jury,
ours is volume 5, 1019 to 20.
Okay.
That's where we spoke about.
Now that's the same site that the prosecutor gave us.
Yeah.
So it looks like we need to read that and figure that out.
Right, so, I mean, the words aren't there. And it's interesting, the words are not there, and yet on the Feretta canvas, the prosecutor focused on one word, and that was considered past tense. I mean, this gentleman had a disagreement with his attorney all the way through, even in the middle of trial, even at sentencing, he was writing letters and still complaining.
What was the specific nature of the troubles with his attorney? It was not clear specifically that he detailed anything in particular.
He alleged two things. One was that his attorney was not introducing evidence that he had told his attorney about. His attorney did not get it, and he wanted the evidence introduced. And he also thought his attorney had lied to him, and he thought his attorney had misrepresented something.
But did the district judge resolve that? In other words, this was without the prosecutor being there. Wasn't there a discussion where it was resolved to the point where he said, let's go ahead with the Jackson versus Dental hearing, which was where he was represented by counsel?
Right, he was. Then it started in the middle of trial when he wanted the evidence introduced, and it continued in sentencing.
Okay. Any additional questions from Ms. Dickinson?
Thank you.
Mr. Missouri, thank you very much. This matter will stand.